Genealogy by Tim, Season 5, Episode 6, recorded October 13th and December 14th, 2025. Today on the podcast, I'll tell you all about my application for the Genealogical Society of Pennsylvania's PALS Lineage Society. That's the Pennsylvania Ancestors Lineage Society, which is a program within the Genealogical Society of Pennsylvania. I'll tell you about the program, that is, I'll describe it to you. I'll tell you why I'm interested in joining, and then I'll read off to you various parts of my application in the hopes of inspiring you to join as well and have your Pennsylvania ancestors recognized by the Genealogical Society of Pennsylvania. All that coming up on Genealogy by Tim. Details about the Pennsylvania Ancestors Lineage Society are available on the Genealogical Society of Pennsylvania's website at genpa.org, and of course I'll link to that in the show notes. But let me read off to you some of the details about the program that are available on the website. First of all, the purpose of the program. The Pennsylvania Ancestors Program offers GSP members a way to honor their Pennsylvania ancestors at the same time they are preserving part of their research. Once an application is approved, members will receive a specially designed membership pin and a certificate including the time period and the ancestor's name. Presentations are announced at the next annual meeting of the Society. Ancestor qualifications. The Pennsylvania Ancestors Lineage Society ancestor must have been a resident of Pennsylvania during one of the four time periods listed. Evidence submitted as proof must be sufficient to prove the ancestor's residence in Pennsylvania during the selected period and to establish direct descendant from the ancestor. And they have here on the site four time periods for which they'll accept applications. The earliest is the First Families of Pennsylvania period from 1638 to 1790, then the Keystone Pennsylvanians from 1791 to 1865, the Pennsylvania Proud time period from 1866 to 1900, and then the Centennial Pennsylvanians time period from 1901 to 1925. The Centennial Pennsylvanians category is a growing category that always ends 100 years prior to the submission of the application. So for example, this year is 2025, and the Centennial Pennsylvanians category ends in 1925, but that'll grow to 1926 next year and 1927 the following year. So essentially the program is open to anyone who can prove descendancy from a Pennsylvania resident who was a resident at least 100 years ago. Up until about several months ago, the Pennsylvania Ancestors Lineage Society was known as the First Families Lineage Society. The Genealogical Society of Pennsylvania changed the name of the program to better reflect the scope of the program and the four time periods. Before, people thought First Families was only for ancestors who came when Pennsylvania was a colony, and that their ancestors were not eligible because they arrived in Pennsylvania in the 1900s or 1800s. In the new Pennsylvania Ancestors Lineage Society program, each time period has a unique certificate and a unique pin for the specific period of a recognized ancestor. This is according to the Frequently Asked Questions page, question 22, which is also posted on the website. So it's a new look for the old First Families of Pennsylvania Lineage Society, which I've referenced before on this podcast, but the same spirit and the same general application process. The membership procedure is listed on the website. An applicant must be a current member of the Genealogical Society of Pennsylvania, as I am. And the application fees for PALS, that is the Pennsylvania Ancestors Lineage Society, are for the review process and are non-refundable. For each application, you must identify your Pennsylvania ancestor, that is the one from whom you are descended. You must read the checklist for submitting a Pennsylvania Ancestors application. This will explain the guidelines you should follow as you research and prepare your application. Step 3 is to read the PALS application FAQ for general information on applications. Then read the research guide on documenting your ancestor. This guide and the FAQs that it contains will help you determine the documentation that you need for your application. Step 5 is to assemble the necessary documentation following the information in the research guide and FAQs. Then check the sources that you use with the Overview of Acceptable Sources page for PALS applications. Step 7 is to complete the application and a sample is provided. Step 8 is to complete the PALS Direct Ancestor Chart. This is a very brief summary of what you would have in your full application. Samples of the PALS Direct Ancestor Chart are also provided. And then step 9 is to review the checklist for submitting Pennsylvania Ancestors application one more time and be sure that you have complied with the guidelines. Step 10, prepare a check for the non-refundable $75 application fee. Step 11, prepare your application package. Be sure it contains complete application package for your ancestor, completed checklist for submitting a PALS application, completed PALS lineage chart, all documents referenced in your application, a check for the non-refundable $75 application fee as well. Now, step 12 could have been step 1, but be sure you are a current member of the Genealogical Society of Pennsylvania. Membership, by the way, is just $45 a year, and with that you get access to members-only portions of the website, free admission to the Saturday and Tuesday special interest group roundtable events, and other benefits. Step 13 is something not to do. Do not send originals of the documents that you're using to prove your descendancy from a Pennsylvania ancestor. Keep the originals because they do not return any submitted items. And then lastly, mail your application to the Pennsylvania Ancestors Lineage Society. The address is given on the site, and I'll be sure to link to that. I intend to hand mine in person because I'm there once a month. Once an application is received by the GSP office, that's the Genealogical Society of Pennsylvania, it is assigned to a Pennsylvania Ancestors Committee volunteer for review. The volunteers are all trained in verifying Lineage Society applications. After completing their review, they notify the applicant with review results. If additional materials are needed, applicants are given the opportunity to submit it. The submitted application and all supporting documents become the property of GSP, and that's the general process, which I have read directly from the Genealogical Society of Pennsylvania website. I am nearly done compiling all of my evidence. I just need to do a little reformatting because I had used the old First Families application, and I just need to do a little reformatting to get that into the new PALS, Pennsylvania Ancestor Lineage Society application, and make sure I've checked off each of the requirements listed in the checklist. Shouldn't be that many modifications, but I'm nearly ready for submission, and I will share with you many of the details of my application in an upcoming segment of today's podcast. Before I tell you all about the details of my application, I want to explain my reasons for applying to this Lineage Society. I'm already a member of the Sons of the American Revolution. I would like also to become a member of the Pennsylvania Ancestors Lineage Society. And the documentation requirements for PALS is a little more strict than the Sons of the American Revolution. So for me, these societies provide a way for me to get my research recognized by a professional organization. I joined the Sons of the American Revolution back in 2018, and I used some of the research that I had available to me at that time. The Pennsylvania Ancestors Lineage Society is a little more strict with the documentation, so for me, this is kind of proving a step up in my research and documentation. So for example, the Sons of the American Revolution accepted as documentary evidence the publication known as the Biographical Annals of Lancaster County, Pennsylvania, which was published, I believe, in 1903. The Pennsylvania Ancestors Lineage Society does not accept county histories like this for documentation. So I had to step up my research a little bit and find other ways to prove the information. Similarly, the Pennsylvania Ancestor Lineage Society requires vital information, that is, birth certificates, for the first three generations. The Sons of the American Revolution did not require that I have my grandparents' birth certificates or my parents' birth certificates. I was able to prove their relationship using newspaper obituaries. So for me, the purpose of joining these societies is to have my research recognized professionally, and then also my reason for joining PALS, the Pennsylvania Ancestors Lineage Society specifically, is that it's kind of a step up in research quality over the Sons of the American Revolution. And that's not in any way to disparage the venerable Sons of the American Revolution. They have been around for generations, documenting descendants of Revolutionary War descendants, and they were there for me when I needed them at that stage of my research ability. But it is, of course, nice to take one's research one step further and also have that research recognized. Now, I had mentioned that the Pennsylvania Ancestors Lineage Society requires vital records for the first three generations. One of the challenges of preparing this application was convincing my parents to share certain sensitive documents for inclusion in the application. So to that end, I want to read a portion of the frequently asked questions where that concern is addressed. This is question number 24 and question number 25 in the frequently asked questions. What will happen to my completed application form? Approved and incomplete physical applications are kept in a secure area at the Genealogical Society of Pennsylvania, which is accessed only by staff going through two locked doors. Newly received applications, which are under review, are kept in a locked drawer in a locked staff office. All applications are scanned as they are received. Reviewers have access only to the scanned copy of the application, which is in a secure folder on a file-sharing site. Access to that site is secure and limited to only essential individuals. GSP plans to preserve the complete application and supporting materials in digital form as part of its mission to preserve genealogical materials. In index applications, excluding individuals in the first three generations or those in earlier generations who are still alive, is part of the plan for the future on the GSP website, and scanned applications following the same restrictions may appear in the members-only portion of the website in the future as access and copyright issues are resolved. Although members may request a copy of an approved application, the requester is sent a redacted application excluding information on individuals in the first three generations or those in earlier generations who are still alive. So that is their privacy policy. And that is the end of the response for question 24. Indicating their privacy policy, the first three generations and any other generations that still contain living people are kept private. The only arguable sharing is the secure folder on the file sharing site. So I'm thinking something like a Google Drive or a Dropbox or something like that that is secure and only reviewers at the Genealogical Society have access to that, but is not disseminated to the public. And when researchers approach a Genealogical Society to see an application, those first three generations plus any generations containing living people are redacted from what is shown to those requesting to see the files. And then question 25 says, how are the submitted applications kept? To maintain security and privacy, all applications are kept in locked storage in a locked area of GSP that is not open to the public. Reviewers do not have personal copies of any of the application materials. See FAQ 24 above for more information. So, if you are compiling your application and you have parents or grandparents who are reluctant to share personal documents, you may help address those concerns by showing them the FAQ page questions number 24 and 25. And then, of course, let them decide if that is acceptable. Of course, any documents that you can obtain from independent sources, I guess, are fair game for you to submit. And those will still be kept private, of course. Information that you cannot obtain independently, you kind of have to get permission from those who have those documents before you submit. And these FAQ questions can maybe help you do that. So in the spirit of preserving the privacy of the first three generations. Included in my application, I will start at generation number 4, and I will describe the documents that I have included in my Pennsylvania Ancestors Lineage Society application, starting with my great-grandfather's birth on February 15th, 1905. I have a Philadelphia City birth certificate for him, and I have a Pennsylvania death certificate for him. He died on the 5th of August, 1959. His name was William Pickersgill Harrison III, and his wife, the former Joanna Christina Smith, was born August 25th, 1908, and I have a birth certificate for her, and she died on June 14th, 1987. I have a newspaper obituary for her. They were married on February 5th, 1930, and I have a marriage license for them. Generation number 5. These are the parents of William Pickersgill Harrison III. They are William Pickersgill Harrison Jr. and Cora Mae Klein. For the father's birth on June 12, 1874, I have a Philadelphia City birth return. And for his death on November 1st, 1926, I have a Pennsylvania death certificate. These death certificates, by the way, are available for free for Pennsylvania residents who sign into Ancestry through the Pennsylvania archives. So it just makes some of this a little easier. When I started doing genealogy, I had to mail away for these, but these are all freely available to any Pennsylvania resident with an internet connection, and I can link to that in the show notes. William Pickersgill Harrison III's mother, Cora Mae Klein, she was born April 1st, 1877. Now, her birth, I do not have a birth record for her, but I do have her birth date listed on her death certificate. She died on May 1st, 1960. I also have as corroborating evidence information from her father's Civil War pension file that indicates birth date on April 1st, 1877. The marriage of William Pickersgill Harrison Jr. and Cora Mae Klein took place on August 14th, 1897 and is documented in Lancaster County Marriages. So there is a marriage license for that on file at the Lancaster County Archives, which is quite likely online now as well, probably on FamilySearch.org. Cora Mae Klein's parents, David Hartman Klein and Margaret Eisenberger. David H. Klein's birth date was October 1st, 1838, and this is provided by his death certificate. He died on March 29th, 1920. Margaret Eisenberger's birth was on December 20th, 1839, and this information is provided on her gravestone, which is in the Millersville Mennonite Cemetery in Lancaster County, and is also published as a death notice in the Lancaster Examiner on the 2nd of January, 1897. The marriage of David Hartman Klein and Margaret Eisenberger took place on October 6, 1859 at the First English Lutheran Church, and I have a marriage record for that obtained on microfilm from the Lancaster County Historical Society, now known as LancasterHistory.org. The next generation, David Hartman Klein's parents were John Klein and Catherine Hogentogler. John Klein identified David Hartman Klein as his son in a will, proved the year of his death, 1876. So I have that will included in my file. And David Klein's 1920 death certificate also identifies his parents as John Klein and Catherine Hogentogler. John Klein's birth date is given on his gravestone, which is at Silver Spring Cemetery in West Hempfield, Lancaster County, Pennsylvania. And his death date is given also on the gravestone, but again by Lancaster County Death Affidavit. And this was kind of like an early death certificate, but it was not necessarily contemporary with the death, so a person could have come along several months or maybe a few years later to attest to the death of the person in question, and it was often used as part of the administration of the will. Mother's birth date and death date, this is Catherine Hogentogler. These are given on the monument at Silver Spring Cemetery. Their marriage took place on November 16, 1830, and was recorded in the personal marriage records of Reverend J.J. Strine. These were transcribed and published in 2001, but I actually saw the originals at the Lancaster County Historical Society, now known as LancasterHistory.org. I saw the originals in person, and they are very fragile, and I would not use them for any old research, but for the purpose of documenting the PAL's application, I went for the originals. Catherine Hogan Togler's parents were Joseph Hogendobler and Mary Heistand. And this was the most difficult relationship to prove, because I could not find any birth or baptism record for Catherine Hogan Togler. So I went with deed records, that is, the transfer of land, from Joseph Hogendobler to John Klein, the husband of Catherine Hogan Togler. And I created a whole appendix documenting the transfer of land throughout these generations. But there is one specific deed, that's Lancaster County, Deed Book E7, page 634, which details this land transfer. And I've included some other deeds that provide additional context. That was one of the toughest links to make here. The identity of Catherine's mother, Mary Heistand, this is given only by county history. This is the Biographical Annals of Lancaster County, Pennsylvania, published in 1903. I may exclude this from the final draft, and that would have the effect of identifying Catherine's mother only as Mary, because that is how she is identified in these deed records. And then I may make a little footnote somewhere in my application that says, well, according to the Biographical Annals of Lancaster County, Pennsylvania, Mary's last name was Heistand, and it's not necessary for proving the lineage, but may be interesting for others who request to see this application for their own research. Joseph Hogendobler's birth was on March 3rd, 1782, and I do actually have a baptism record from the First Reformed Church of Lancaster, Pennsylvania for him, and his death occurred on May 25th, 1850, and this is from a gravestone monument at the Silver Spring Cemetery in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. The mother's birth, the mother Mary Heistand, or Heistand, was on March 15, 1792, and her death was on January 8, 1840, and these are also from her monument at Silver Spring Cemetery in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania. And her monument, of course, shows only her married name of Mary Hogendobler, so it does not help identify her last name, and she is not buried near other Heistands in the cemetery, so that doesn't quite help either. So she may have to be listed only as Mary. And their marriage occurred on February 1806. This I have only from an online source, so I may drop that for the final draft. I don't think they want just online secondhand information. It's not required to prove the descendancy, although it is perhaps interesting for future researchers. Rather than include the document, I'll probably just add a footnote. By the way, on this online family history, it does indicate the marriage as February 1806. Joseph Hogendobler's parents were John Hogendobler and Catherine Boyer. John Hogendobler is the qualifying ancestor for Sons of the American Revolution. So I have research up to and including him for inclusion in that society. He was born October 31st, 1745, and died May 13th, 1820. Now I have a record from Pastor Henry B. Schaffner documenting the death of John Hogendobler on May 13th, 1820, and it also lists his birth, October 31st, 1745. And then after that, I have one more generational link yet to prove, and that is John Hogendobler's birth as the son of Nicholas Hogendobler, who is the original ancestor who came to America. That information is not yet in my application, but it's going to be one of the last things I do to wrap up this application. And that's the type of documents that you'll need to compile and organize to gain admission to the Pennsylvania Ancestors Lineage Society. As part of this application, I went into a lot of detail in land records to prove that Joseph Hogendobler was the father of Catherine Hogendobler. And I'll summarize those records for you in the next segment. This application I've included an appendix that traces the descendants, three generations of Hogendobler descendants from land records. Now, John Hogendobler purchased a fairly large plot of land in December of 1789. And I just want to read to you just the descriptions of the documents that I've included in this appendix. All right, and it goes like this. Lancaster County land records further support the parentage of Catherine Hogendobler Klein and her father, Joseph Hogendobler. In the absence of primary documents proving the birth of Catherine Hogendobler Klein to her father, Joseph Hogendobler, an 1847 deed of assignment between Joseph, his son Jacob B. Hogendobler, and his sons-in-law, Henry Zimmer and John Klein, has been offered to prove the parentage. This appendix offers additional support by providing historical context for the 1847 deed. Mapping the land from its descriptions in the various deeds and wills included in this appendix proves that the land remained in the family from its original purchase by Catherine's grandfather, John Hogendobler, in 1789, through its sale to Catherine's husband, John Klein, in 1848. The documents uniquely identify the Joseph Hogendobler of the 1847 deed as Catherine's father and eliminate the possibility that the deed refers to any other Joseph Hogendobler's then living. So, the Joseph Hogendobler that who is my ancestor had a son, Joseph Hogendobler, and also had an uncle, Joseph Hogendobler. So, I included these documents just so it's clear, you know, exactly who is the, or I should say, which Joseph Hogendobler is in my lineage and who is referred to in these documents. So the first appendix, how many appendix items do I have here? I have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 appendix items. Appendix A. These appendix items are labeled A through F. So Appendix A, John Penn the Younger and John Penn the Elder by their respective attorneys to John Hogendobler. This is the original purchase of land in Pennsylvania by John Hogendobler from the grandsons of William Penn. This is Deed Book KK, page 453 to 455. This document is a deed that describes a tract of land purchased by John Hogendobler from John Penn the Elder and John Penn the Younger through their respective attorneys, John F. Mifflin and Anthony Butler. The John Penns were both grandsons of William Penn. The tract is situated in West Hempfield Township, Lancaster County, Pennsylvania, just north of the city of Columbia and with a western border along the Susquehanna River. The deed identifies the tract as containing 244 acres and 87 perches. The tract is depicted visually in an undated draft of Hempfield Manor, circa 1789 to 1790. See Appendix B. John Hogendobler parceled the tract out to his five sons in a will dated 1820, the year of his death. See Appendix C. Among those sons was Joseph Hogendobler. Joseph would later reference his parcel in an 1847 deed of assignment that also names his daughter, Catherine Hogendobler, as a beneficiary. In the absence of birth and baptism records for Catherine, the 1847 deed is the only contemporary identification of Catherine's parentage of which I am currently aware. Catherine's husband, John Klein, would go on to purchase Joseph's former partition in full in 1848. See Appendix F. So, then I have the full deed of that land here and also some reference information from the Lancaster County Recorder of Deeds website. And some of these deeds have been typed by people at the Lancaster County Courthouse. So I'm not looking at the original handwritten deed here. If the deed was typed, I did not transcribe it. The typed version is good enough. But if the deed is written, handwritten in a register, I went through the effort of transcribing them in a typed manner. Now, Appendix B here. This is a draft of Hempfield Manor called Chuquisulongo Hills, situated in Lancaster County. This is at the Historical Society of Pennsylvania, Cadwallader Family Papers. I think I spelled that wrong. So here we go. I'm making edits as I go here. This document is a visual map of the area known as Hempfield Manor, also then known as Chuquisulongo Hills, which was situated in West Hempfield Township, Lancaster County, Pennsylvania. Hempfield Manor lied just north of the city of Columbia, bordering the Susquehanna River at the west and extending to the community currently known as Ironville at the east. The land was surveyed by direction of Anthony Butler Esquire, who was the attorney for John Penn the Younger. The map's legend names John Hogentogler as the owner of lot number 2 at 244 acres and 87 perches, the same acreage reported in the deed of sale in 1789. Although the map is undated, it is stored in the same flat file as a similar map of nearby Conestoga Manor, which is dated September 1789. Both maps were copied by Charles de Craft, and the land for each was surveyed by direction of Anthony Butler. John Hogentogler purchased lot number 2 in late December of 1789, so the map of Hempfield Manor was likely drafted in 1790 or shortly thereafter. The map of Hempfield Manor identifies the exact location of John Hogentogler's land purchase, with the tract's southern boundary meeting the Susquehanna River at a distinctive bulge in the river's east bank. The bulge is the site of a rock formation through which the Point Rock Tunnel was later carved. This former railroad tunnel is now a landmark on the Northwest Lancaster County River Trail and is accessible by recreational pedestrians and cyclists. The courses that define the boundary of lot number 2 in the 1789 deed of sale are identical to those depicted in the draft of Hempfield Manor, with the exception of the 8th course, which is identified as south 80 degrees, west 44 perches in the deed, but depicted as south 86 degrees, west 44 perches in the draft. The east bank of the Susquehanna River has changed substantially since the Hempfield Manor map was drafted. Around the turn of the 20th century, the construction of a new railroad causeway through the river from Point Rock Tunnel at the south to Chickie's Rock at the north resulted in an enclosed body of water known locally as Kerbaugh's Lake. After floodwaters damaged the causeway in 1936, the lake was filled and the land was reforested. The area now forms the western part of Chickie's Rock County Park. The Northwest Lancaster County River Trail, which runs through the park, remains a good approximation of the Susquehanna River's former east bank as depicted in the draft of Hempfield Manor. The trail is easily visible on modern digital maps and satellite images. So I have this map here that shows where the land purchase was. That's Appendix B. Appendix C is John Hogentogler's will, drafted 25th March 1820, proved 15 May 1820. This is in the Lancaster County Archives, Will Book M, page 399-402. And what I have, this is available online also, FamilySearch.org, probate records 1683-1994. Here's my description of this document. This document is the last will and testament of John Hogentogler. In it, John parceled and devised the tract of land he purchased from the grandsons of William Penn in 1789 to his five sons, John, Jacob, Samuel, Nicholas, and Joseph. The courses that define the tract identified in this will are noticeably different from those in the 1789 deed of sale. The resulting tract now measured 319 acres and 67 perches. Though larger, the tract is the same general shape and is in the same general location as the one purchased from the Penns in 1789. John's will specifically cites the 1789 deed to demonstrate his ownership of the tract. John parceled the tract in four ways, devising 49 acres and 74 perches in the southeast to his son John, 43 acres and 44 perches in the south to his son Jacob, and 40 acres, 68 perches in the southwest to his son Samuel. John devised the remaining 186 acres and 67 perches in the north jointly to his sons Nicholas and Joseph Hogentogler, who were also the executors of the will. John additionally ordered his sons, John, Samuel, and Joseph, to make 8 annual payments of $1,167.51 to his daughter Catherine, the wife of Jacob May, and further ordered his sons, Nicholas and Joseph, to make 8 annual payments of $1,167.51 each to his daughter Elizabeth and to the issue of his late daughter Mary, former wife of the late Henry Clare. The will places liens on the lands devised to John's sons until the ordered sums were paid. Liens on the parcel owned jointly by Nicholas and Joseph were released by deed of 13 February 1822 and recorded April 2nd, 1835 in Deed Book E, Volume 6, page 7-9, not included. So, after that money was paid out, land was owned, I guess, free and clear. Nicholas and Joseph would soon partition their jointly owned parcel among themselves by deed of June 14th, 1823, see Appendix D. In 1847, Joseph assigned his partition jointly to his son Jacob B. and sons-in-law John Klein and Henry Zimmer. The 1847 deed also named Joseph's daughter Catherine as a beneficiary, thereby proving her parentage. See Appendix E. Catherine's husband, John Klein, bought Joseph's partition in full in 1848. See Appendix F. So, we're kind of getting in the weeds a little bit with the deeds. So this one is handwritten in the Register of Deeds, and I transcribed the document. I typed it all the way out, and also made maps using LibreCAD, the computer-aided drawing software that shows the land. All right, so there's 3 documents to go here in my application. And if you've stuck with me this far, you are a trooper. Appendix D is a deed of partition. Joseph Hogendobler and Nicholas Hogendobler. The land was partitioned on January 14th, 1823. So John Hogendobler left a tract of land to his sons, Joseph and Nicholas, jointly. They had that land partitioned. And here is my description of this. This is from Deed Book E, Volume 6, pages 10 to 12. This document is a deed of partition for a parcel of land jointly owned by Joseph Hogendobler and his brother Nicholas. Joseph Hogendobler devised land to each of his 5 sons upon his death in 1820, whereas his sons John, Jacob, and Samuel each received distinct parcels of land at the southern end of the tract. His sons Joseph and Nicholas jointly received 186 acres and 67 perches at the northern end of the tract, see Appendix C. The two brothers had the parcel partitioned in early 1823. Nicholas received the northern partition at 94 acres and 40 perches. Joseph received the southern partition at 87 acres, 20 perches. The deed of partition referenced John Hogendobler's will of 1820, and the courses defining the outside boundaries of the two new partitions are identical to those described in John Hogendobler's 1820 will. So I have an extra word, the, in here. I'm going to edit out. In addition to defining the land that would eventually be purchased by Joseph's son-in-law, John Klein, this deed of partition is significant because it identifies Joseph's wife as Mary. This corroborates the biographical sketch of their grandson Henry Klein, as published in John Franklin Migenis's posthumous Biographical Annals of Lancaster County of Pennsylvania in 1903. That source identified Joseph Hogendobler's wife as Mary Hestand. It also distinguishes the Joseph Hogendobler of these deeds from other Joseph Hogendoblers then living, such as Joseph's uncle, Joseph Hogendobler, who married Maria Ava Straub, and his son, Joseph Hogendobler, who married Fanny Schenck. Nicholas's wife, Elizabeth, is also identified by first name in the deed of partition. Joseph assigned the rights to his partition jointly to his son, Jacob B. Hogendobler, and to his sons-in-law, John Klein and Henry Zimmer, in 1847. That deed of assignment also names Joseph's daughter, Catherine, as a beneficiary. The following year, in 1848, Catherine's husband, John Klein, purchased Joseph's partition in full. See Appendix F. All right, so we have this deed included in my document, together with some reference information from the Lancaster County Recorder of Deeds website and a Leroy Cad drawing of the land that was jointly owned by Nicholas and Joseph Hogenauer and then subdivided. Appendix E, Joseph Hogenauer to Jacob B. Hogenauer. All right, this is a deed of assignment, April 14th, 1847, and recorded the same day in Lancaster County Archives Deed Book E, Volume 7, page 634 through 37. It's also available on FamilySearch.org, Pennsylvania Lancaster Deeds, 1729 to 1867. This document is a deed of assignment from Joseph Hogenauer, jointly to his son Jacob B. Hogenauer and his sons-in-law John Klein and Henry Ziemer. Joseph was nearing the end of his life in 1847, and he called upon his son and two sons-in-law to help manage his final affairs. Joseph assigned all estate, real and personal, houses, messuages, tenements, lands, hereditaments, and appurtenances whatsoever and whosoever, to the three younger men, but he did not describe the real estate specifically in this deed instrument. Joseph accepted the room in the first story of the house I now live in for my own use during my life from the assignment. So his son Jacob B. and sons-in-law John Klein and Henry Ziemer all controlled all the land around the house and most of the house except for that one room where Joseph would live out his final years. The property was assigned with the intention that it be either sold or leased with the proceeds of the sale or lease used first to settle any of Joseph's outstanding debts, then to pay for the upkeep of the property if it is leased rather than sold. And then $225 was to be paid to Joseph himself for his personal use and benefit in equal quarterly installments. Any money remaining after these payments was intended to be divided equally among Joseph's children, whom he identified as Jacob, John, Catherine, wife of John Klein, and Mary, wife of Henry Ziemer, and Joseph. This is the only contemporary document of which I am currently aware that identifies Catherine Hogentogler Klein as a daughter of Joseph Hogenauer. This deed of assignment is missing any description of the property in question that would tie it to the tract originally purchased by John Hogenauer in 1789 and devised to Joseph Hogenauer in 1820. A deed of sale the following year in 1848 described the property in full detail. So we have to include one more document here that ties it all together so that we have our full lineage from Catherine to her father Joseph and to her grandfather John. And I'll just read the description of this last document here. Hogenauer, Joseph assignees to John Myers. Okay, land was conveyed on March 11th, 1848 to a John Myers, and it was repurchased again by John Klein 3 days later on the 14th of March, 1848. So that land was jointly owned and controlled by three men, Jacob Hogenauer, John Klein, and Henry Ziemer. That land was transferred or sold to someone named John Myers, and I don't know John Myers. He may be just a real estate broker of some kind. But anyway, John Klein purchased the land back from him 3 days later and was the full owner and controller of that land. Let's read the description here of this last document. These documents are conveyances that together have the effect of selling the former property of Joseph Hogenauer to his son-in-law, John Klein. In the spring of 1847, Joseph Hogenauer assigned all interest in his real and personal estate jointly to his son, Jacob B. Hogenauer, and his sons-in-law, John Klein and Henry Ziemer. Joseph's deed of assignment instructed the assignees to sell the real estate and split the proceeds among several named beneficiaries, including himself and his daughter Catherine. the deed of assignment did not specifically identify the property that was to be assigned and sold, but referred to it only as all estate, real and personal, houses, messuages, tenements, lands, hereditaments, and appurtenances whatsoever and wheresoever. In the following year, in March of 1848, the three assignees, Jacob, John, and Henry, sold the entire partition to a man named John Myers, who then resold it back to John Klein. I am not currently aware of any familial relationship between John Myers and Joseph Hogendoller's assignees. He is identified in the deed of sale only as a teacher from Manor Township. The first deed of sale from Joseph Hogendoller's assignees to John Myers, dated 11 March 1848, identifies the partition as one from Joseph Hogendoller's 1847 deed assignment. It lists all courses that define the boundaries of the partition and also identifies the partition as the same one created in 1823 by deed of partition between Joseph Hogendoller and his brother Nicholas. Lastly, the partition is described as containing 87 acres and 20 perches, a figure consistent with the 1823 deed partition. The second deed of sale, from John Myers to John Klein, dated 14 March 1848, does not describe the partition in detail, but does identify it also as containing 87 acres and 20 perches. It is presumably the same partition as in the conveyance of 3 days prior, from John Hogendoller's assignees to John Myers. These two conveyances complete the chain of evidence of Catherine Hogendoller's parentage, beginning with John Hogendoller's initial purchase of the tract from the Penn family in 1789, to John's devising a parcel of that tract to his sons, Joseph and Nicholas, in 1820, to the partitioning of the parcel between Joseph and Nicholas in 1823, to Joseph's assignment of his partition to Jacob Hogendoller, John Klein, and Henry Ziemer in 1847, and lastly to the sale of that partition to John Klein, with proceeds of the sale presumably shared with Catherine. The latter deed describes the partition consistently across the three generations of Hogendollers. What happened to the partition after its sale to John Klein remains the subject of future research. It is known that John sold a thin sliver of land at the west end of the parcel, along the east bank of the Susquehanna River, to a woman named Anna Houston in the spring of 1851. On historical maps such as the 1864 Atlas, the 1875 Atlas, and the 1899 Atlas, John's sons, Samuel, Ephraim, and David Klein, are seen residing in the area, which came to be known as Kleinsville. As of this writing, the portion of the partition west of Chickies Hill Road is part of what is now Chickies Rock County Park. The populated place now occupying the portion of the partition east of Chickies Hill Road is still known as Kleinsville to this day, and is visible on modern maps at the intersection of Kleinsville Road and Old Chickies Hill Road. So, that is just kind of a full summary of what I have in my application for Pennsylvania Ancestors Lineage Society, with a description of documents that I've included and my appendix, which shows from deed records the parentage of three generations of early Hogendoblers. And then on the last page of this binder application, I have a picture of what the land looks like today. Not a photograph, but like a Google Maps sort of thing. I think it's an OpenStreetMap, actually, with the borders of these land purchases kind of drawn over it. So just to give folks reading this an idea of where all this land was. And that's it. Hopefully over the coming weeks I will straighten that out and put some final touches on it. So recently, when the Genealogical Society changed the name of the First Families Lineage Society to PALS, Pennsylvania Ancestors Lineage Society, they also revamped a lot of it. They gave a new a summary form to fill out, and also promulgated some new and clearer rules on what should be included in an application. So I'm going to do some editing of that just to make sure it's all in compliance with the new requirements. And then hopefully sometime early next year that will be ready to submit, and I will be a member of the First Families Division of the Pennsylvania Ancestors Lineage Society. And that concludes this month's podcast, ladies and gentlemen. Let me tell you, I have not been doing all the genealogy that I've been hoping and enjoying doing. A lot of work during the day, a lot of chores at night. I've been doing a lot of exercising. And yeah, I just decided yesterday, or on Friday, I should say, it's Sunday morning now, that you know what? I'm going to pull back on the exercise a little bit because I don't want to miss any more genealogy podcast recordings. I had a streak going of 161 days where I did 30 to 45 minute exercise routines. And it's like, you know what? I can't keep a streak like that going because Sunday mornings I miss my podcast recordings. And I want to get back on that. So we'll see. Maybe there'll be a middle way between exercise and genealogy. But yeah, we're at the end of the year, and I've got only 6 episodes this season, so it's a short season. But yeah, time to get back on my podcast. Until we meet again, keep on digging. Your next Family History Adventure awaits.